Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the news and stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students Director of Policy and Public Affairs, Ron Matus, sits down with Miami-Dade Superintendent Alberto Carvalho. It may come as a surprise to those used to the tired back-and-forth debates about choice versus traditional schooling that America's fifth biggest school district is all in on riding the tsunami of choice. But that's exactly how Superintendent Carvalho wants it. He credits growing success in the Miami-Dade district to competition. Competition to deliver choice at a high level, strategic deployment of programs, and rigorous analysis. What does the future look like for Miami-Dade? Carvalho says, we ain't seen nothing yet. He says the forces of automation, digitization, and artificial intelligence will perhaps drive the most powerful shift mankind has ever seen in the history of education. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the interview.
Thank you again for your time. I want to run some things that I think I see about your district by you, and you can tell me whether I'm close or not.
Okay.
Well, so first off, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, you mentioned that you saw this tsunami of choice coming, and you decided
right.
basically to get out the surfboard. You said, you know what, you can either succumb to it or you can surf it, and I choose to surf on it. And so when I look at your district, I see amazing choices, more so than more districts even in Florida, where a number of different districts have, you know, gone down the road of choice, but not as much as Miami-Dade. So is it right for me to see school choice as a defining, really distinctive feature about your district?
You are absolutely right about it. It's actually one of the, used to be five, now seven, distinctive elements that I credit our success to. So you are absolutely right. I mean, recall that when I was appointed superintendent, 30% of our students were enrolled in untraditional programs. And, you know, just you look at the spectrum of a variety of choice in our school system. We dramatically exploded at that percentage to about 70% this year. And the goal for 2020 is reaching 90% of students enrolled in non-traditional programs, meaning programs that they make a conscious, rational decision to enroll in on a basis of the relevance that that they have to the students themselves.
So you're talking about
a
district
yes.
where virtually every student is enrolled in a school or a program of their choice.
That is correct. That is the goal. It's been part of our DNA for a while. We embedded it as part of our strategic vision. It was highlighted during our first ever district-wide accreditation by Advanced Ed. And I wanted to do that because I wanted those external and internal elements to be witness to the mandate of ubiquitous universal choice that is a guarantee to students in Miami-Dade. So yes, I believe that it was a powerful decision then. It continues to be a powerful decision now. Over 1,000 different choice programs in Miami-Dade, by far the most extensive choice portfolio of any school system in the country, large or small. And I absolutely vindicate and stand by proudly by the assertion that you made, that yes, choice was a rational decision. It was strategic in its nature, and it was quite frankly well-rooted in the research that supports, you know, rigor/relevance through choice makes for more engaged students, therefore more powerful academic results.
Well, so how much of the trend lines, and you do have a number of rising trend lines, how much of your rising student achievement across these different measures do you credit to your expansion of choice? I mean, is there evidence to show that?
We've researched it, and we've actually written research briefs that address that essential question. And it's not disputable that students who are enrolled in these choice programs usually perform academically better than those who are not. And I think we ought to celebrate that. But the celebration should not last very long. We ought to replicate the success and continue to amplify it through equitable access to the same opportunity that's now being granted to 70% of our kids but needs to be granted to the rest of them. And the deterrence there sometimes, it's not the child, it's the parent. You know, is the parent being sufficiently demanding of choices for their children? Are they sufficiently aware? And that, quite frankly, is a body of work, an arena of work that we are tackling now. Mm-hmm. But yes, there is clear evidence that effective choice forces or enables more powerful academic results.
Period. Okay. So I have no doubt that that is a primary motivator. I mean, you want your kids in a district that is, you know, got a lot of low-income kids, a lot of ELL kids. You know the demographics better than I ever will. Yeah. That you want them to succeed. So you want this this relevance and this ownership of their learning to propel them. But isn't there also a competition component to it? I mean, you live this every day in a way I never will. I mean, you've got a ton of charters. You've got a ton of private schools. Mm-hmm. There's scholarships all over the place. We all know more choices coming. So how much is the competition engendered by these non-district options a factor in the reinvention of your district?
Yeah, I think it would be fair to say that I'm by nature, a reasonably competitive guy, and my team is as well. But I can also tell you that we stopped trying to out-compete others long ago, and now we're in a phase of the work where really we're trying to outperform ourselves. And it really was a transition. We have seen the growth, the charter school movement in our community, but we've seen an even more aggressive, to your point, growth of public school choices within the previously known as traditional schools in Miami-Dade. So, yes, I would credit in part our success and the explosive nature of choice programs in our system to, at least in part, to competition. Okay. But it was strategic competition. It was not just to win the gold medal at anything. It was actually competition to deliver choice at much higher levels, being strategic in the deployment of choice programs by analyzing their existence by zip code across the district and filling in the gaps. And as we were looking at that, yeah, we were looking at all choice. Were there high quality charter schools in certain areas? Were there, mm-hmm. High quality magnet programs in certain areas? Should we continue to expand single gender schools, even looking at specific strands of programs and trying to ensure that all zip codes reflected offers to kids in those neighborhoods?
But if you had not stepped up and began offering even more choice than you historically had and not stepped in and created all these magnets, these amazing magnets and career academies, isn't it true that with all the non-district options out there, that somebody would have? In other words, going back to your beautiful metaphor, had you not responded by surfing the tsunami, would it not have come in and swamped you?
It would have. That's a given.
Okay.
And that's why I said it then. That's why I believe it today.
Okay.
That we recognize, I personally recognize, my team recognized that the choice tsunami was upon us. And I was not going to do what a lot of my colleagues did, which is let's hope and pray it doesn't hit us, or let's just allow this to go through like all things. This is a fad that will go away.
Right. They resisted. You reinvented.
Right. We embraced it and reinvented. That's a good word. We embraced it and reinvented it, and in the process emerged stronger, leaner, more agile in our ability to develop programming and offer programming, implementing programming that was non-traditional in nature. And in the process, we changed the school system. And we did it, by the way, during the best of times, as I described to you, in the middle of an economic crisis the likes of which the nation had not seen.
Yes.
So we leveraged that crisis as a powerful opportunity to reinvent ourselves through choice. So there was critical need up front. Need led to efficiencies. Efficiencies really spurred innovation. And innovation led to district-wide transformation, which is choice-driven.
Okay.
Absolutely right. We recognize that up front. The competition or whatever other word people would want to use, was imminent. I could anticipate the policy shift in the state of Florida and across the country, and we were right. It has, quite frankly, materialized exactly as we predicted. But rather than being a spectator or a victim of it, we were an active participant in it.
Okay, got it. I'm glad I think I saw that part accurately. Well, tell me if I saw this part accurately. Would it also be fair to say that you guys are also surfing the accountability wave? And I think that's what I saw at Datacom. That's what I saw in there. You guys were doing 100 different things to move the needle for your lowest performing schools, your quote-unquote fragile schools, and you were doing it in a hurry. So are you also surfing the accountability wave? Is that fair to say?
That we are selling. We're not surfing it. We are selling it. And I say that because, you know, the wave, being a physics guy, right? A wave is actually a particle motion that moves vertically up and down. And then, depending on wavelength, it actually moves, you know, in a translation mode as well. But the wave is created by a significant disruption somewhere, right? And a tsunami usually is a seismic event that causes the magnitude and amplitude of that wave. The accountability, I actually see it more as being, as driving us, much like the wind and its different forces and directions affect the positioning of a cell to move the vehicle in the right direction. And how we adjust the cell on the basis of, so some people, it's counterintuitive. My God, if you have wind, you know, at your face, how in the world can the ship still move forward? Well, it can if you adjust the cell properly. And I think we did. We leveraged, anticipated again, and leveraged accountability changes in a way that I believe was not done in many districts across the state and the country. You're absolutely right. Data is our superpower. It's part of our DNA. The fact that we use data to differentiate support to schools, the need allocation to schools, the support allocation to schools on a basis of need. The fact that we use data professional development to train up-and-coming and current administrators and teachers, that we're able to develop, you know, best-in-class dashboards that easily allow the viewing, the analysis, the manipulation, and the reaction to in terms of strategic deployment of actions in schools. That's all, to a certain extent, the function of the accountability evolution.
Okay.
I can tell you that if there had not been a focus on accountability, I am not sure that we would have moved as swiftly and, quite frankly, as smartly as we did with our own internal systems.
Well, that brings me, that's a great segue into my next observation that I wanted to run past you. Here's what I saw as a backdrop to all the things that you were doing, which was, you know, for lack of a better term, the Jeb Bush revolution. I kind of wondered whether that revolution essentially reset the operating system for public education in Florida with top-down accountability and bottom-up choice, and then, you know, different players could come on the scene and develop different apps on that operating system. Would it be fair to say that, you know, the things that were put into motion, the quote-unquote reforms for 20 years ago, is a big part of the backdrop against which you operate?
I think that you would certainly have to credit some of the original thinking specific to more accountable school systems, a policy statewide that posed sometimes inconvenient questions and challenges that focused not just on the inputs, but also absolutely considered aggressively the outcomes, and attempted to differentiate the treatment of schools on the basis of performance.
Yes.
So I would say that, yes, at least part of the credit is owed to some of those early elements. And look, I lived through it. Even before I became superintendent, I've been superintendent 10 years, those reform movements started 20 years ago.
Yes.
Maybe even a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned them as a lobbyist, policy guy in Tallahassee. I monitored them. Sometimes I fought against some elements when I felt they were going too far.
Yes.
On the other hand, I absolutely embraced many that I felt were spot on, were appropriate, and they were good for kids, they were good for teachers, they were good for education, even though the implementation in some instances was difficult and painful. Because, you know, the establishment of a new normal, you know, overcoming that gravitational pull of the status quo is difficult.
Well, I know you haven't, Mr. Superintendent. I know you have not been hesitant to be critical when it warranted it, and I've seen a number of your criticisms on a number of different policy fronts. But unlike some other people who are critical, I've never seen you go after the operating system as a whole. It's always been, here is my detailed critique of testing or of funding or of funding for charters or of the rollout of standards, et cetera. It's not been an attack on the system as a whole. It's been getting it right through some nuanced positions. Okay.
I thought that the theory of action was solid.
Okay.
Sometimes, over the better part of two decades, sometimes the operationalizing of the theory of action faced some challenges that could have been prevented. I don't have to tell you, in the sort of the yo-yo game of assessment, you know, one year, every single subject area needs to have a complementary assessment for the purpose, not necessarily of elevating student performance, but because statute required a teacher evaluation that was at least in part driven by student data. So that rush to have an end-of-year assessment for every single course taught in the state of Florida was nearly insane, right?
Yes.
So you're absolutely right. I picked apart and debated, and won some, lost some, certain elements of. But I am driven by accountability, and I believe accountability is important. Some people equate accountability with testing. Accountability is far more robust and powerful than assessment of students. And I think that's what we've gotten right here. You know, we use accountability, we use data, we use measurement, we use support systems, we use differentiated instruction and differentiated approach and support on the basis of accountable systems that are data rich. So, once again, your conclusion is spot on.
Well, I've heard you say in several places that, you know, if you can do what you've done in Miami-Dade, then this can be done anywhere. And
yeah.
I guess this
and why
is...
why isn't it?
Well, not only that, but I wonder if that's true. And I say that because, mm-hmm. one, the operating system is different here than it is in a lot of places. Not many places have this intense landscape full of choice. Not many places, frankly, Mr. Superintendent, have you. So is it really that translatable to other settings?
You know, you probably have heard me say this. Anytime I speak about this transition, the evolution from what appears to be an impossible condition situation into an inevitable realization, right? And I think it is possible, answering your question specifically, to the extent that there are equal amounts and levels of belief. I really do believe, and it's biologically proven, that these kids can learn. It's not an issue of ability, innate ability, or capacity. They can, to the extent that we believe they can, but believing alone isn't sufficient. Then you need to have the right amount of skill and will. And that is, those are the two obstacles that would prevent the scalability or the expansion or the replicability of some of our success stories here into other districts across the country. So, and the skill, by the way, is an easier set to master than the will. You know, anything we do, as you know, is pretty much available publicly. Any public records request can get our practices. Anybody who would ask, we can share the dashboards with. Anybody who wants to visit and witness a datacom process can witness so. They can understand what our professional development over the summer is, Synergy, for 3 weeks. That's all learnable. So there is a skill set that can evolve, but I think that's not where the biggest impediment is.
Well, so what is the hang up then?
Impediment, it's the will set. Is there the political strength to actually prioritize what's meaningful in terms of practice for students, or are the adult interests so powerful, and is the status quo so convenient and comfortable that they prevent good practice, good pedagogy, a good data-driven instruction, good support systems, different ways of manipulating a budget to address all kids in an equitable way, not an equal way. And that will proposition is a tough one. I think stands as the biggest obstacle to educational leaders and practitioners of education across the country. Yes, sometimes you have all the great ideas, you have the right belief system, you actually have the appropriate skill set, but you're hitting your wall, your head against a political wall that will not budge. And I, quite frankly, identified that to a certain extent in Miami-Dade about 10 years ago. But as I believe I conveyed to you, we decided to go around, over, and under those forces and appeal directly to the consumers of education, the parents and the students, energize those communities into a level of dissatisfaction that would support reform efforts. Mm. Not easy, but sometimes it is the only means by which you can accomplish what you must accomplish.
Well, what do you see as the biggest challenges ahead? I mean, you've done a lot. You've been there 10 years.
You detected some. So talk about specifically, and so at the granular level, Miami. But then I think the big questions for the country as far as education is concerned, and I'll start Miami. We're at 89% graduation rate. That 11% is a huge priority for me because those are a reflection of the 11% of kids whose parents and grandparents didn't graduate either. Mm-hmm. So it'll be much tougher work as we continue to push towards a 95% graduation by the year 2020. The conundrum that certain zip codes communities face in terms of the opportunity gaps kids face prior to the very first day of school, we are tackling those aggressively. Without tackling them, by third grade, it will be nearly impossible to get some kids to perform as they should at grade level. So early childhood education, the guarantee that there are social systems that really identify and provide for those gaps, they are the reality for many kids, who then obviously attend schools in communities where the performance is persistently low. So continue that transformation, but accelerating it by not playing only with the factors that are under our control, but actually influencing the pre-factors outside of our control. Middle school reform. I mean, you saw that there are some academic factors that is indicative of some failures in the past.
You're not getting the same traction in middle school.
That is correct. That is why we spent the better part of a year and a half to 2 years analyzing the data, analyzing best practices across the country and internationally.
Right.
And this year, I think we're onto something. Because we launched a pilot program into 9 middle schools where we changed everything. The calendar, the school day, the types of courses students take, the level of awareness, the social-emotional learning platform, what kids eat in the cafeteria, very, very different from anything that was done before. I believe that there's great promise associated with our middle school reform effort. And again, it will be accountability and data that will prove is right or wrong. And we will know within 6 months as whether or not our investment, our bet, were correct. And then the last one, I think this is at a macro level. 10 to 20 years from now, how will we be teaching kids in America, in Miami-Dade? And I think the most honest answer to that question is we don't know.
Yes.
And I say that because I think the mode and model of educational work will be significantly different from anything we know and understand today.
Yes.
Because the mode and model of work, period, will be significantly different from anything and everything we know today. as a result of three powerful forces: digitization, automation, and artificial intelligence. You put those three forces together, and you have to anticipate a dramatic shift, perhaps the most powerful shift we've seen in education in the history of mankind. Consider the possibilities. So where, when, how, and by whom? Where, when, how, and by whom kids will be taught will be very different than the reality today. That's where I'm pushing my staff. That's why we are tackling these conversations right now. We are observing trend lines that are not being considered in education, innovation, and other sectors, and learn from them to identify the next big earthquake that will cause the next big tsunami.
I love iPrep. And I have no doubt that it was ahead of its time, is still ahead of its time. But will it be ahead of its time 10 years from now?
It will not. Yeah. I can guarantee you that. It will not. It will not. I cannot tell you specifically what will be current 10 years from now. But the success of iPrep, because we did change everything, right?
Yes.
The school day, the calendar, the coursework, digital content, so many different modalities of learning at play in one place within this atmospheric, right, respect and responsibility, which are individually observed, in the students' behaviors. Yeah, it was transformational, revolutionary when we created it, and continues to be very, very unique. It is not at all the reality across the state. It is great. It will continue to be great. But it will no longer be an example of innovation 10 years from today.
Okay.
All right. The three forces that I declared, trust me, will influence the world of work across all sectors, and we would be fools if we did not consider their impact on education.
I mean, can a district still deliver? I mean, with things changing as rapidly as they are, Mr. Superintendent, is a big district nimble enough and flexible enough, innovative enough to respond to all these things that are going to start changing at warp speed?
Ron, I can tell you one thing. I know of a lot of very small districts that are not performing well. And one would think
yeah,
that swift boat reform is easier than, you know, they're in an aircraft carrier reform, right? It takes much longer to turn a course of an aircraft carrier than a swift boat. That's why they're called swift boats. So I'm not exactly sure that size matters, but I'm not exactly sure that as far as educational reform, size is the most dominant factor.
Okay.
I think to a certain extent, large districts have the ability, through the power of research, through the development of systems, to actually anticipate, prepare, develop, implement the next big thing, sometimes faster than small districts, just because of the skill set that they can hire, right? But I think that we are venturing, to your point, we are venturing into an arena, an era that is unprecedented. This is not just, you know, Gutenberg's press was significant, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was significant because now it empowered people to not just empowered people to actually be able to read. First was the Bible, but that was just the beginning. This is multidimensional. What is about to happen in education is multidimensional in its nature, and it cannot be ignored. I think it is a good thing, but with all good things, there are pitfalls.
Yes.
And I think those ought to be studied up front, considered up front, so that we don't create a new environment where we are data-rich, opportunity-rich, but continue to observe the inequities that America has taught us over the better part of, quite frankly, hundreds of years.
Yeah.
I am the eternal optimist. So, yes, I do believe that the experiences of Miami-Dade are scalable and replicable.
Okay.
I do believe that despite the tumultuous, revolutionary way in which education will be transformed through automation, robotics, artificial intelligence, digitization, that at the end of the day, it will be better. To the extent that it is rooted in humane principles that make sense for kids, that is personalized, that is individualized, that continues to provide social opportunities and socialization opportunities for kids. If we don't consider that, if we, using my earlier metaphor, decide to just bury our heads in the sand, quite frankly, what will we be preparing kids for? I keep talking about 2031, because that's the year that kindergartners today will graduate high school. What is the expectation of them by 2031, when a lot of the industries, because of the elements I just described, will be out of business, which means work will be different. So what do we teach them? How do we teach them? How we prepare them for that reality? That's what's consuming my time. That's what's keeping me up at night.
Okay. Well, Superintendent, if anybody can do it, it would be you and Miami-Dade. You've been unbelievably generous with your time. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to learn from you and your district. Thank you so much for all of this. I could ask you for questions for another hour and can keep learning from you, but I know you got a massive district to run. So,
well, thank you.